Hello, and welcome back to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and today we're going to talk about the meeting that I recently attended in South Africa. This was the first meeting of the 18th International Affiliate of the VHL Family Alliance International. It's a new group that's starting up in the country of South Africa, and we're very pleased to welcome them to the worldwide family of support groups for von Hippel-Lindau disease. As you know, that's my primary job, is working with people with von Hippel-Lindau, which is a hereditary cancer syndrome, and it affects every ethnic group in every country of the world. We've made contact with over 15,000 people with this rare disease in 102 countries over the past 15 years. And this latest sister group in South Africa is the first in the continent of South Africa, and we're very pleased to welcome them. Let's first do a little housekeeping for the program, and I'll bring you a little music of South Africa, and then Althea and I will talk about our experience there. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger, by Clenton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. This was my first trip to South Africa, my first trip to the continent of Africa, and I didn't quite know what to expect. I think the first thing that struck me was the weather, because here we were at the southern tip of the continent of Africa, and it was warm, and I really had to check a map to discover why. It seems that Johannesburg, which is in the center of the country, is approximately as far from the equator as Miami. So that's pretty close, and I had expected it to be a lot closer. You know, the southern tip of the continent of South America goes all the way to the 55th parallel, which is approximately as far from the equator as Seattle. But the continent of Africa does not go that far south. It's much farther from the South Pole and much closer to the equator. So Johannesburg is about where Miami would be, and Cape Town is about where San Francisco would be. It's a little bit cooler, but still quite temperate, and a pretty Mediterranean climate. It's described as a Mediterranean city. So most of the time we were in those two cities, and it was a little rainy, but very pleasant weather. And then we went up to one of the national parks, Pilanesberg National Park, to see some animals. And we went down to some of the vineyards to see the beautiful vineyard country of South Africa. So we got, in a short period of time, in about 12 days, we got a very nice taste of the country. And in addition to that, of course, the primary reason for the trip was to go to this meeting of people who have von Hippel-Lindau disease and some of their family members and two of the doctors who work with them to try to help them learn better how to manage their health. And this is something that we've done in many countries of the world. We started doing it in the U.S. about 15 years ago, and then different countries have joined our international family over the years. So we now have a handbook that gives people some hints on how to manage their health, how to go about screening, find problems early, treat them as well as possible, and hopefully come through it with few deficits. There is no cure for VHL, but we've tried to develop better ways of managing it. And so as you listen to our discussion about the meeting, think in terms of really any complex medical condition and how you would deal with it in a different healthcare system. It's the differences in the healthcare system that I'd like you to focus on in today's program. And just to get you warmed up a little bit, I'm going to play you some music. We went to dinner at a restaurant in Cape Town called Mama Africa, and we heard a wonderful marimba band with a very African sound to a familiar tune. See if you can realize what tune they're playing. The people of South Africa are very diverse. 80% of the population is Black African, 2% is Asian, mostly from India, and 9% is of European descent. The remaining 9% is what's called colored. And during apartheid, during the period from 1948 until 1990, there were three distinct classes of citizens. There were the Blacks, the whites, and the coloreds. And these were three tiers of society with different sets of rights and different status in the culture. The whites were on top, the blacks were on the bottom, and the coloreds were in the middle. And there was a systematic way of keeping these peoples separate and competitive with one another. That system was abolished in 1990. A number of people fought for freedom over a 40-year period to try to end apartheid, most notably Nelson Mandela. And Nelson Mandela spent 28 years in prison as a political prisoner. He had been accused of treason because he disagreed with the government. And he and many other political prisoners were held at a place called Robben Island, which is an island off the coast of Cape Town. A little bit like Alcatraz to San Francisco, there's Robben Island to Cape Town. And after 28 years in prison, he came out of prison preaching reconciliation. That very act has given him an enormously high level of credibility amongst all the people of South Africa. And I have to tell you that everyone I spoke with glowed when they spoke about Mandela, of any color. So it's really an amazing recovery that the country is making. So 80% black, 9% white, 9% colored, and 2% Indian. So who do you think we met with when we went to Johannesburg? Here is Althea Johnson to share with you her recollections of the meeting.
As far as the meeting was concerned, I expected what I saw.
Yeah.
I didn't expect to see any black people.
Right.
And I expected that I would be the first black person that anyone there had seen with VHL. Mm-hmm. And I was glad to be that person. I wanted everyone to know that black people do get VHL, And I felt, you know, kindness and everything in the room.
Right.
And I wanted them to know that, you know, it's kind of equal opportunity.
Right, and it affects not only whites and blacks, but also people of many other
mm-hmm.
of the ethnicities that are represented in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
People from India, from Indonesia, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very diverse population. I probed a little bit with Lizette, trying to understand a little about their healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think a lot of the diagnosis challenges there, as every other place in the world, have to do with the way the healthcare system is constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking about how there are basically two healthcare systems. There's the private one and the public one. And the private one is basically if you have insurance versus if you don't have insurance,
mm-hmm.
Then you fall into the public sector. So in the private sector, they have good hospitals. They're not quite as good as what we see here, or maybe I should say they're not quite as comprehensive as what we see here.
Right. And I was struck by the fact that they would have to go to different places for different things. For instance, in a big metropolitan hospital in the U.S., you can see practically every specialty that you would need.
Mm-hmm.
But there, you need to go to an eye doctor in a separate building, maybe in a separate town,
mm-hmm.
and then to your endocrinologist in a separate building in a separate town. That I was struck by that.
Right. That even in a big city like Pretoria, which is the capital,
mm-hmm.
And there is a university medical center there, still the institutes are stovepiped, and
mm-hmm.
as you described, you have to go to a different institute to take care of a different organ system.
Mm-hmm.
And for a multifunction disease like VHL, that makes it very, very complex.
Yeah, that makes a clinical care center program like we have here not really possible there. It would have to be
right.
different.
Right. And then if you don't have insurance, you're thrown into the clinic system. And with the clinics, as she described, they're overworked and underpaid. And you might show up to work as a doctor at the clinic, and there are 200 people in line, or in the queue, as they say in South Africa. So there's 200 people queued up to be seen. And at the end of the day, maybe you've seen 125 of those, and the rest of them, you ask them please to come back another day.
Right.
So if you've come in from a small village and had to walk an hour to get to the bus stop, and then take some series of buses to get into Pretoria, and now you're told to come back another day,
what's the likelihood of you doing that?
Exactly.
When you've got to get food on the table.
Right. The other thing she was saying is that a lot of people go first to a traditional healer.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would go and see if the healer could take care of them. And if they present with headaches, then the healer would work at that, I'm sure.
Well, I found it kind of, you know, I was kind of saddened to hear that the person or the healer would want to know, well, what did you do to bring this on yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Or you know, who cursed you? What did you do to get cursed? And then they would work on trying to get rid of whatever the curse was or undo whatever it is you might have done to bring this upon yourself. Not that it's something that just happens because it just happens.
Right. Right. So you'd start with traditional medicine.
Mm-hmm.
If that doesn't work, you might go to the clinic at some point. And then we know from clinic settings all over the world, that's not the place to diagnose a rare disease. Because
mm-hmm.
Especially at an overworked clinic, they're going to work their way down the decision tree and play the odds. Number one on the list is hypochondria.
know,
and they work at it like that. But for them ever to get to one of the rare diseases is pretty tough. You have to have a lot of good luck. So I can see where the problems would mitigate against someone from a village getting a diagnosis of a rare disease, any rare disease.
I'm not quite sure I understood this, but even with private insurance, like with a disease like VHL, you have to do these, you know, routine screenings to, mm-hmm. you know, keep up with your health. After you've used up your allotment, then, you know, that's it for you. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, there seems to be some maximum per year or for the program. It depends on what kind of insurance you have. Mm-hmm. But here, too, you can max out your insurance.
I got the impression that you could max out things there much faster than you would here.
Okay.
I was kind of surprised.
Yeah, I don't know enough about that. I can see if I can ask Lizette about that. But there certainly are gatekeepers who have to approve your getting a scan, any of these more expensive things. There are a series of approvals you have to go through, which is similar to what we have here. Mm-hmm. But the other part is that the imaging machines are not as available. They're just not as many around mm-hmm. the country. Mm-hmm. One of the women there that I had been corresponding with for about 10 years now has metastatic kidney cancer, and so she had asked her doctors about some of these new drugs that you hear about, and there are no clinical trials going on right now in South Africa, so they put her on interferon, which is the one well-known standard of care for metastatic kidney cancer, and they refused to put her on the expensive new drugs. I mean, these can cost like $5,000 a month or more. So she was upset about that, and I told her the good news is that VHL usually responds pretty well to interferon, so hopefully it'll work for her.
Let's take a little break here. I want to play for you a song that was done by a young man who was playing music on the waterfront in Cape Town, and he had a CD for sale, so I brought the CD along, and he's given me permission to play this song for you. His album is called Unico Musico, Unique Music, and he says here his name is Meduzi Mubaya. I've undoubtedly pronounced that wrong. 21 years old, and he plays the pipes. These are actually electrical conduit pipes. It's not a flute. It doesn't have finger holes. It's just a pipe, and he plays a rattle that he's made with 20-cent pieces inside of a ball valve ball. So it's unique music that his grandfather and he worked out, and with lovely African rhythms. So I hope you'll enjoy this unique music. You'll find additional information about this program and the topics that we're discussing at powerfulpatient.org. This is the powerfulpatient.org, and we're speaking with Altheda Johnson about the latest meeting for von Hippel-Lindau disease, VHL, in Johannesburg, South Africa. When you look at the healthcare situation in South Africa, you have to remember how many very, very serious issues they've been dealing with. For example, in the 1960s and 70s, nearly half of children born in South Africa did not live past their first birthday. Today, the infant mortality rate is about 55 out of 1,000 live births, which is still a little high. It's about like Bangladesh. But it's getting there. It certainly made a significant improvement over what was true in the 60s and 70s. So you'll hear us talking about a lot of progress in South Africa, even though there's still a great deal of work to be done.
Did you hear any stories that were different from the kinds of stories you've heard here in the U.S.?
Actually, no. It's it just brought to mind the kinds of stories that I hear on the 800 line, how similar they are, how a person will go from one crisis to the next, to the next, to the next, and have such a long period of time before they are actually diagnosed. And that's the kind of thing that I've heard there. It was very similar mm-hmm. to what you hear here about VHL.
And probably a little bit more like we heard in 1994 or something when we were just starting out, because the level of visibility of VHL there mm-hmm. today is about where it was here in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
They've been working on a lot of other things on the agenda.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think that HIV is probably much more relevant to them than VHL would be.
Right. What was they were saying is about 25% of the population has HIV, mm-hmm. which is pretty awful.
Yeah.
And lots and lots of AIDS orphans, as they said, yes. children who've lost both parents to AIDS. Mm-hmm. So yeah, AIDS is much more the crisis, the health crisis going on right now.
Mm-hmm.
What about South Africa in general? I know I really didn't have much of a preconception of what I was going to find there, but it was very different.
Well, I've been telling people since I've gotten home that South Africa is not what you think of when you think of Africa. At least for me, it wasn't. I, of course, had never been to any part of Africa before, but from what you see on TV when a country is in crisis and people are rioting and protesting and whatnot, you see a very kind of devastated town. You see a very poor-looking town, a very undeveloped town. And in South Africa, things were very developed. It was almost as if you were, you know, walking through Manhattan. The buildings were tall, and the streets were clean, and which is not so much. I can't really say that about Manhattan so much. But it was a very well-developed town, and I also was struck by the fact that there seemed to be a lot of cooperation between races. When you think of apartheid, and it wasn't that long ago that it was ended, I was thinking that there might be more unrest between the races, and it wasn't like that at all. Actually, I kind of felt forgiveness there.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like, to me, like people were really working together.
I was struck by that as well, that apartheid was in force from 1948 to 1990, so 42 years. And it's only been 14 years since the first democratic elections in South Africa, so it's pretty new. And yet in that 14 years, I think they've made an astounding amount of progress in healing some of those wounds, and as you say, engendering cooperation.
I think so too, and I think that they've come in some ways further than people in the U.S. have come.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of slavery and when it ended, and Jim Crow when it ended, and the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that in a lot of ways they've come further than we have in the States.
Right. One of the things I noticed was that one of their pillars of democracy that they talk about
mm-hmm.
is reconciliation.
Yeah.
So
there are 7 pillars of democracy, and I can't name them all right now, but I think reconciliation is probably one of the main ones, and I think that was, without that, they would not have made the strides that they have made
right.
so far.
Reconciliation and respect is another one that struck me as an integral part of democracy for sure, but one that we in America sometimes don't pay quite enough attention to.
Yeah, I was struck by the fact that there are 11 national languages there.
Right.
And that means that nobody was marginalized.
Right.
Everybody was important. And so it's not just one language that's important. All of them are. And I was struck by the fact that so many people speak more than one language. And when I say more than one, they can speak as many as three or four or five different languages. So I was very impressed with the people there.
Right. And just knowing what difficulties English and French have given Canada, it was amazing to me to even attempt to have 11 official languages.
Mm-hmm.
Because it means when you put out an announcement, for example, in Canada, you have to translate it also into French. And there's a lot of resistance of doing even that. But in South Africa, to have to do that for 11 languages is like incomprehensible.
Yeah, and nobody seems to be complaining about it.
No, but I think you're exactly right that it meant that no one was marginalized and everybody feels like an integral part of the community of all of South Africa. One of your friends described Africa as an industrialized nation inside of a third world country.
Mm-hmm.
So even though, as you say, Johannesburg is similar to New York City, and Cape Town is probably similar to San Francisco, that around them there are the parts of Africa that are small villages and the plains. It's not the jungle like we see in the movies, but the savanna, the plains, with lots of wonderful animals and lots of very interesting people living the way their families have lived for thousands of years.
I'd like to play you another song here. This is by the Abonwa BC Brothers, who also entertain at the waterfront at Cape Town. And this is from their CD. This is a group that's been together since 1997, and their name means the Happy Boys. They are Xhosa by birth, but they sing most of their songs in Zulu, which is the predominant African language in South Africa. So this is a song from the Abonwa BC Brothers of South Africa.
Shosholoza,
shosholoza, vulezondaba, thimelas pumenzansa.
Shosholoza,
shosholoza, vulezondaba, thimelas pumenzansa.
Benu ya
baleka, vulezondaba, thimelas pumenzansa.
Benu ya baleka,
benu ya baleka.
I'll be right back with Althea after this message.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
And if you call our hotline, one of the wonderful volunteers you might speak with is Altheda Johnson. So before I go back with Altheda, I wanted to let you know that the seven fundamental values that are written into the South African Constitution, or sometimes referred to as the seven pillars of democracy, because they are depicted on seven pillars outside of the Apartheid Museum in Johannesburg. These are democracy, equality, reconciliation, diversity, responsibility, respect, and freedom. And this is a very carefully undertaken effort to be inclusive of all parts of South African society. Having been through a time when one race tried to lord it over the others, they decided they didn't want any of that anymore, and they've really made a concerted effort to be inclusive of everyone. When Mandela was working with de Klerk in 1994 to 96, he basically said to them, "We need you, the white people, just as much as you need us, the black people. And it's only by working together that we can achieve peace and prosperity for the whole country." And so that's what they've striven to do, is to have peace and prosperity for everyone in South Africa. It's a work in progress, as it is in every country. We have to say the same in the United States. It's always a work in progress. But I think that they've made an admirable strides. And there are some things that we could learn some lessons from. I mentioned earlier that everyone spoke very highly of Nelson Mandela. As a matter of fact, we were given a book of quotations from Mandela. And here are a couple of selections. "Never, never, never again shall it be that this beautiful land will again experience the oppression of one by another. We enter into a covenant that we shall build a society in which all South Africans, both black and white, will be able to walk tall without fear in their hearts, assured of their inalienable right to human dignity, a rainbow nation at peace with itself and with the world. Our single most important challenge is therefore to help establish a social order in which the freedom of the individual will truly mean the freedom of the individual. We must construct that people-centered society of freedom in such a manner that it guarantees the political liberties and the human rights of all our citizens." Let's speak some more now with Altheda.
One of the things I noticed was Soweto. What struck you about Soweto?
Well, I think that I was surprised to see that so many of the roads were paved, because way back when there were the uprisings and they were shown on the news, it was dirt roads and the dust kicking up. And I was also surprised at how many tinny shack houses they were, these corrugated metal houses they were, and how close they are together. You can open your door and practically, you know, stick out your arm and touch the next one. Mm-hmm. When you look over the hillside. I mean, it's like rows and rows of them very close together. And then when you go through these towns, there are, you know, there's a part of Soweto that's called Beverly Hills because the houses are so modern and nice and new. But even there, they're very close together.
Right, just to give people a little background, during the end of apartheid that was so much in the news and was one of the few things that I think most Americans really knew about South Africa, we saw these little shacks. They're about, say, 10 feet square. They have three or four walls and a corrugated tin roof. And as you say, they're very close together. This is a community of 6 million people. It's a suburb of Johannesburg, and this was the black section where Mandela lived as an attorney, where Bishop Tutu grew up. And so all of these people were basically herded into this one area, but they created a village, if you will, of 6 million people. No running water, no electricity, no sanitation. They all had little outhouses, but so close together that it's truly amazing, this collection of people. And yet a kind of village structure, which is different than when you see this kind of Tinnishak community in South America. They'll be like jumbled on top of one another and sometimes up the mountainside, and much more haphazard than what we saw. What we saw in Africa was much more, it had an integrity of its own. Mm-hmm. And then in the last 14 years, now what's changed is people can own property, and therefore they're fixing it up or bulldozing the shack and starting over.
Black people can own property.
Black people can own property for the first time in the last 14 years. And they now have electricity to all those homes and running water. So a lot of people have added bathrooms. And they've made it just, as you said, they've paved the roads.
The government is building new housing, and it's you know, an expensive job, and it's taking a while. The housing, I mean, it's still, while it's better housing, it's still just four walls a lot of times. It's not a big, fabulous house with three or four bedrooms.
Right.
It's a one-room place, but it will stand up to the weather and...
Right, and have modern facilities.
Right.
Television is one of the things they were talking about, bringing television in, which also gives you media coverage,
mm-hmm.
Which helps in communications with the government, and running water and electricity for everybody. So anyway, it's a tremendous amount of progress. They still have a ton of work to do. They're by no means completely healed, but I was very impressed with the pace of it.
Yeah, I was too. Considering the scope of the job that has to be done,
right.
I think they've made a lot of progress.
You're listening to The Powerful Patient with Joyce Graff, and we're talking with Althea Johnson about our visit to South Africa and our meeting with patients with VHL in Johannesburg. Please go to powerfulpatient.org, where you will find a program guide that accompanies this show. It will detail the music that we've played and give you some background information on the subjects that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support. Please donate to thepowerfulpatient.org and bring us back another day. Thank you.
And the land is so beautiful. We went down the Atlantic coast, which is very similar to the California Pacific Highway, where you see craggy coastline and wonderful vistas out over the ocean, and the wine country is beautiful.
blue sky and blue ocean, green and brown and gray hillsides. It was very beautiful.
Let's talk a little bit about the traveler's woes that we had. As much planning as we did, we still had a few bumps in the road that we should probably share with people. My silly little one is that I did manage to lose my voice by the end of Friday, and I think what it was is allergies. So I didn't even think about taking along allergy meds, but I actually lost my voice during the trip. But that was pretty minor. The accommodations were the biggest hurdle. You want to talk about that?
Well, I think that I've been telling people that the South African way of thinking of accessibility is much different from what Americans might think of as accessibility. And while our hotel, our first hotel in Johannesburg, was very lovely, it was in no way accessible while this was their wheelchair accessible room.
Mm-hmm.
The wheelchair could not turn in the bathroom. They had one bar on the wall that was stationary and one bar that swung. And if you grabbed it, you can expect to hit the deck because it's going to move when you move. I couldn't really get under the sink to brush my teeth because there was kind of a hard curtain there to cover the pipe. My chair would not go on either side of the bed. I had to get in the bed at the foot of the bed and scooch back. I could go into the room one way and one way only. I can go in and back out. That's how little space there was. I would not have been able to open the our room door by myself. There was no way I would have been able to do that.
Right.
There was no peephole for me, you know, even if I could have gotten to the door, to look out to see who was there.
The peephole was too high.
Yeah. People was for a standing person.
Right, right. And it was very interesting because we thought we had communicated fully about that. You know,
but we had communicated fully. We had communicated fully, but what when we were saying accessible, you know, we were thinking American accessibility. And they were thinking South African accessibility. And so when we said, is the room wheelchair accessible, they said, of course it is. Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
But we never did specify, well, can my wheelchair get next to the bed? Or, you know, are the grab bars
right.
in a place where I will be able to get them? That kind of thing.
Well, they even termed it a, quote, paraplegic room, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept using that term. And at one point, one of the hotel administrators said to us, well, you know, we didn't understand the extent of the lady's disability.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, she's a paraplegic. And you said, bill this as a paraplegic room. So where's the disconnect? But I think nobody had ever really put it to the test in the same way that you did.
Right. And, I think that what they were thinking is... someone that uses a wheelchair but can stand up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not me. But I think that that's a mistake that a lot of people make because so
right.
often people use wheelchairs, but, you know, I've seen for myself people get up and I'm amazed. Oh, I thought they were, you know, paralyzed, but they can stand up and do certain things. You know, you can't stand on your legs very long sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so you use a wheelchair, and sometimes people don't realize that people often are in wheelchairs, can't stand up at all. So.
Right. I think that was particularly true in the airport because a lot of people, elderly people or people who
mm-hmm.
use crutches, will ask for wheelchair assistance just so they don't have to walk the distances.
The distances, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the airline sees a lot of those. and much fewer people who really can't stand at all.
Mm-hmm. And we ask for wheelchair accessible vehicles, and we ask several times. I've heard Fred in here, you know, before we left, and the vehicle is wheelchair accessible. My wife will be able to get the wheelchair in the van, and they say yes, because they feel like as long as my chair folds up and they can get it in the truck or the back seat or something, mm-hmm. then it's wheelchair accessible. But very often we were in like SUV type vehicles, so you know there was room for the wheelchair to be folded up, but then it was a big job to get me into the seat because you know they're so high up.
Right. You used a sliding board, and if it's more or less parallel with the wheelchair, you can slide across pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Even if it's a little bit higher, you know, you can kind of slide up or slide down getting out. But when there's a whole foot difference, it's a huge job. I mean, I have to be actually lifted mm-hmm. into the vehicle, and that was a problem.
Right, and your good husband is willing and able, but, you know, it's a big job nonetheless.
Yeah.
So, but once we got in the vehicles, we did great.
Yeah.
What we had hoped for, though, and what wheelchair access usually means in the U.S. or certainly in New York, is that you can drive the wheelchair on board with you in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we only met one of those. Ironically, at Robben Island.
But the one thing I have a problem with, there was not one tie down in any vehicle that this wheelchair actually got into, even the vehicles at the airport. There was no way to tie the wheelchair down.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, is really against the law in New York not to tie the wheelchair down. And these vehicles were going slowly. I mean, the vehicle at the airport, they were going very slow, you know, so it wasn't really a problem. And I had even mentioned to the driver at Robben Island, well, you're going to be careful, right? And it was a slow tour around the island, so it wasn't really a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of like riding in the front seat of a car without a seatbelt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at any time you can get go over a bump or have to stop short, and you could potentially fly out of your chair.
Right. You know? And I know in one of those vehicles at the airport, I hung on to you for dear life.
Mm-hmm.
My arms braced around the chair because I was afraid the chair was going to fall over when he did a corner.
Right. And see, that wasn't my wheelchair, and that was even worse.
Right.
That was their aisle chair or straight back chair.
It's a much narrower chair, so
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have the wheel spread for stability.
Right, and you don't have the balance because a lot of times there's no armrest, and
right.
I think there might have been one belt across me. It wasn't even properly belted, that chair, so it was a little scary.
But other than that, we managed really quite well.
Mm-hmm.
We had some nice adventures and a lot of very nice people who helped.
Yeah. Everyone was very willing to help.
Yeah. We even saw one handicapped employee
mm-hmm.
in our travels at the cable car going up to Table Mountain in Cape Town. There was a gentleman who was in a wheelchair who had no legs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of interesting to see that they were actually trying to hire handicapped people as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they didn't keep them undercover. I think in a lot of countries they do. I think even here, people are surprised to see me out. I got a comment from a lady yesterday. I went to hear a lecture yesterday, and when we were leaving, the lady says, "I'm so glad to see you. I didn't know her from a hole in the wall. Oh, I'm so glad to see you're out. You keep coming out." And I got the impression like she thought that maybe I stayed home in bed under the covers. And I get out almost every day. You know that often you call here and have to leave a message because I'm not here.
Right.
So I was kind of surprised to hear that. And so that forced me to tell her, well, I just got back from South Africa. So there.
That's great.
So that caused me to have a little conversation with her about South Africa and what it was like there for me and whatnot. But I just wanted her to know that, you know, I don't stay home all the time.
Right.
You know, this is not my first time out in the year.
That's great. And you've been taking calls on our hotline now for, what, almost 15 years?
Yeah. Probably, yeah.
Right. And helping people learn how to manage their health with VHL. Thank you so much for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. And so this trip to South Africa was the opening of our 18th international affiliate. That totally blows my mind. Because 15 years ago, I think I didn't know anybody with VHL. And then I met Susan Warnick, I met you, and we've been building it ever since. And we're now in touch with more than 15,000 people with this disease in over 100 countries. And when I say 18th international affiliate, this will be the 18th group that's actually formally incorporated themselves and becoming a proper charity in their own country and really working with a group of people in the country to learn how to manage their health and work well with their medical professionals in the country to improve the visibility of VHL and the rate of diagnosis. So it's very exciting, and the folks in South Africa have a lot of work to do, but it's really exciting to see that beginning. I also encourage them to make contact with England and Germany and Holland, where so many of these people's families came from. We might be able to trace their families back into those countries and see how the experience of people with that very same genetic flaw may be the same or different in another country.
I was speaking with somebody who was asking me, is VHL really equal opportunity? Do you know any black South African or any black person in Africa with VHL? And I said, well, of course not. I don't know anybody. And she says, because while you're black here in the U.S., you're mixed.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not fully African. And you don't know anybody that is a black African with VHL. So is it something that really is a white disease? That made me kind of think, but then I thought, well, DNA mutations, they don't discriminate. Anybody can have a DNA mutation.
Right. Yes, and there are people in Japan and China who are not of mixed race who have this disease. We've seen people in Brazil who are of African and Native South American who have this disease. I'm not sure if we know someone who is purely black African who has it yet. But I know that I've had inquiries from Chad, from a couple of other countries in Central Africa, and we have two large family strains in Tunisia who are more Arab descent than black African, and in Egypt for sure. So it's in many countries. I think we'll learn the answer to that over the next 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, and I think that for me it won't be surprising that it really doesn't discriminate and everybody gets it.
Yeah.
Everybody can get it.
Yeah, I think so too. Because in the countries where the medical system is not developed to the point where you can diagnose a rare disease very easily, we have a very low rate of diagnosis, but that doesn't mean it's a low rate of incidence.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that's who actually got this disease named.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and they made contact with us. But we've had a lot of people in India and Pakistan recently beginning to get a diagnosis. So that's rising. And hopefully with the work that we're doing with our fellows in South Africa, we'll make the rate of diagnosis greater in the years to come for everybody. And of course, as we have more affluent Black Africans in South Africa and the other countries there, they have access to the private healthcare system. So if the private healthcare system is improved, then they should get the improved care as well. But in any country where there's political unrest, where the war and AIDS are at the top of the agenda, everything else tends to fall off the bottom. War, AIDS, tuberculosis, typhoid, those five take up the lion's share of attention in many countries of the world. Just getting dinner is right.
Well,
I think you made a wonderful impact in South Africa, and I really appreciate your making the effort to go.
Well, it was my pleasure. It was an opportunity of a lifetime, and I did not want to pass that up.
Great.
And I'm very glad that I went.
Thanks.
It was a very worthwhile trip.
Anything else you want to leave with folks?
That it's a beautiful country. It's just a beautiful country. Unbelievably beautiful.
Right. And it's beautiful to see the way that the people of South Africa are working together to make it a beautiful place to live.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, thank you very, very much.
Welcome.
People sometimes ask me why it's so important to me to know how VHL is experienced in other parts of the world. You'd think with a rare disease there'd be plenty to do at home, and you wouldn't really need to worry about other countries as well. It's partly for their benefit, but it's more for our collective benefit. When we see, for example, how people with the very same genetic mutation, the same tiny little misspelling in their gene, have a different experience in one country as opposed to another. I mentioned connecting the people in South Africa with their cousins, if you will, their cousins many times removed, who may still be in Europe, and seeing whether their experiences are the same or different, because they're eating different foods, they're living in a different ecology. How much is the air quality or the pollution a factor in their experience of VHL? What can we learn that we might help people to do better with this disease even without a miracle drug? Is there something in the food supply that can help? And those are the kinds of things that we need to know, and that by sharing our experiences with other people in other parts of the world, we can learn how to manage this disease much better than we've ever known before. And the same is true for many diseases. So look beyond your own self, look beyond your own country, and see how this disease is experienced in the world. It's a revealing thing. It also broadens your horizons. And for me, because I was told for so many years that there were only 9 affected families in the world, that was a ridiculous statement on the part of the doctor who made it. He didn't know what he was talking about. I now have visited, spoken with, and hugged people with VHL in 23 different countries. We have 18 international affiliates out of those 23 countries, and I'm proud to say that the visits and the personal connections that we've made together have been part of the impetus for making those organizations a reality. I hope you've enjoyed your little trip to South Africa with Altheda and me, and if you look at the program guide, we'll give you the pointer also to some of our photographs. Next time, we'll talk about keeping a journal and other ways to help you manage your stress. And in the meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. See you next time.